You're listening to EPN, the e-podcast network.
Welcome to Enterprise Radio, the signature show of EPN, the Entrepreneur Podcast Network, your channel for exclusive interviews with entrepreneurs, small business owners, and some of the world's top executives who share business strategies and insights that can all help you build your business, leading to your business success. And now, broadcasting from anywhere between Brazil, South America to Los Angeles, California, it is your host, Eric Dye.
And this is Eric Dye, and once again, welcome to Enterprise Radio, a part of the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Tax time is upon us, and if you owe sometimes, it can be problematic. That is because Americans have a hard time saving. Each year, consumers are asked about their saving intentions, and each time they claim they will save more money, invest it better, and spend less frivolously. Examining why Americans can't seem to save is the job of one research firm named Motive Index. Motive Index is the only research company that uncovers real consumer motivation through the digital observation of thousands of people. They don't believe in focus groups and online studies, and in a world where our economy is in a state of disarray and retailers need to continue to sell, this firm plays an important role. Here today are Ujjwal Arkelgood and Jason Partridge, co-founders of Motive Index, to tell us more. Welcome, gentlemen, to Enterprise Radio.
Thank you for having us. Great to be here.
So if you would, tell us more about Motive Index and why the company was founded. That's a great place to start.
Great. So Motive Index is a research company, and as you already rightly said in our introduction, our focus is on studying consumer motivations online. Our company was founded because 5 years ago we realized that the richest source of information to study people and to get beyond the rational reasons that people give us to explain why they buy the products they buy or why they do the things they do, the real answer lies on the internet. Because on the internet, we can now study thousands of people real time and get beyond the what and the how to really understand the why. At the end of the day, what are those unspoken motivations that drive consumers to do the things they do, most often irrationally? That's really our focus, and we do it using a team of PhD-level sociologists to study consumers for our clients, and we study 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 consumers relevant to a business that we're working with, and the net result is that we're able to get beyond sort of the what and the how and really help our clients understand why their consumers do the things they do.
And most helpful, I would think. Now, how do you differentiate yourself from other research firms?
So our research firm is based on it's founded on a simple philosophy. Everything we do in our lives is driven by an underlying belief or a value system that we as human beings share. And those beliefs and values drive us to purchase goods, services, to build our identity in a certain way, to talk about certain issues, and so on. Unfortunately, most of the research industry assumes that just because we have a certain age, a certain income, we live in a certain place, just because we belong to the millennial generation, that we will behave in a cookie-cutter manner. And as a result, every research firm focuses on those rational, tangible factors to define and predict human behavior. And our philosophy is the exact opposite, which is that let's forget about how old somebody is. Let's forget about how much money they make. Let's first understand what actually drives them. What are those underlying beliefs, those values that motivates somebody to make a decision on a day-to-day basis?
So the example that we love to use is you know, you go into a Whole Foods on a Saturday morning, you're going to find an 18-year-old guy and a 49-year-old woman. They've got different habits. They've got different kind of things that they love. But there's something that ties them to that brand. There's something that from a values and a belief set, you know, drives them to that store to spend $8 on asparagus water. But if you can find that thing, if you can find that belief that they have in common, that's where you can really start to crack the code. And that's what we're trying to do with our clients on a day-to-day basis.
So why are traditional marketing research firms not effective at times?
Sure. So, you know, we certainly don't want to negate the impact of traditional research firms. They do fantastic work. But here's the challenge. Traditional research firms are great when you already have a product and you need a few tangible questions answered. For example, should we make our product green or blue? I can put a bunch of consumers in a focus group and ask them that question, and they'll help us get to the answer. So in essence, what I'm trying to say is that if the decision you're trying to make is in the middle of a funnel, is related to optimizing something for your product, your services, your marketing, communications, and innovations, then it makes sense to employ traditional research firms. However, if you're trying to get at consumer intent, if you're trying to understand why does my consumer say one thing but actually do the exact opposite, that's really where traditional research firms, which rely on asking people why they do the things they do, they fail, they fall apart, because as human beings, we tend to rationalize every single decision we make, even though it's actually emotionally led. And as a result, when we employ traditional methods like surveys, focus groups, in-depth interviews, oftentimes the real insight gets lost because the human being on the other end, the consumer on the other end, is trying to either portray a sense of self or tell you the things that they think you want to hear.
I like to think of it from the standpoint of, think about, you know, myself. I'm Jason, I'm getting married, and so, you know, you can go, you can ask me if I'm getting married or I'm not getting married, and I'll tell you, and there's a lot of social media listening or a survey or a focus group will get to that level of information. There are a lot of research companies that are doing some really interesting groundbreaking work to get past the rationalized articulation of what I'm saying and try and get to like the feelings. So they'll go one step further and they'll say, okay, so you're getting married. Now we're going to help you articulate why you're getting married. And that, those kind of processes, you're starting to get to the notion of, you know, well, I'm marrying her because she's my soulmate, or I'm marrying her because she makes me feel really good about myself. The problem is that the real reason that Jason got married is because my wife reminds me of my mom. Now that's not something that I'm going to tell a stranger. That's not something that I'm going to share, you know, openly, and it may not even be something that I fully understand or can see myself. Those are the kind of unspoken motivations that when you go and you look at large groups of consumers and you're studying culture at a scale of 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people, we're actually able to start to see the patterns that reveal some of these unspoken actions and motivations that are driving people to make decisions that they may not even be able to articulate themselves.
As entrepreneurs yourself, what key advice can you provide for those looking to get into the research field like you and your company?
Sure. And, you know, again, we are a year-old company and we've had incredible success. So I'm happy to provide advice and we're happy to provide advice, but I say this with the caveat of, we're new in this field and in many ways are learning just as much as other entrepreneurs themselves are. But I think the big realization for us and our passion in the research industry is really driven by the fact that human beings are actually much simpler than we make them out to be. And the entire big data movement has made people focus on looking at more and more data and doing more and more complex calculations and building complex algorithms and all kinds of technology-based solutions instead of asking the underlying question of what is it that's actually missing in the research industry today and how can we actually help our clients, so the people who hire research firms, to get two things. One, a better understanding of the people who buy or will buy their products and services, but B, develop greater empathy for the person on the other end of that table to better understand the underlying insecurities, vulnerabilities, the underlying motivations that drive people instead of just looking at people as a bunch of numbers and as a bunch of trends and patterns that are taking form and shape in the marketplace.
And, you know, just building off that, I think that one of the key realizations that we had when we started the company was that there was such a desire by clients to get to why their consumers were doing the things that they were doing. And while there was these, you know, telephone books of rational information and data that they had access to, they kept coming back to this notion. And the reason why we seem to resonate is because we are unlocking those emotional triggers that are providing the context to understand all that other rational data that the clients already have. So when we talk to, you know, other researchers who are doing incredible work in you know, studying kind of brain patterns to see how people are reacting to things, we get so excited because it's going beyond, you know, the typical way of going and asking a question and observing and dealing with all that subject bias to really start to try and unlock and understand how can we better understand consumers in a way that's less intrusive, that doesn't interrupt, and that really starts to understand who they are as emotional creatures, because really that's where we believe intent comes from. And the more you're able to marry emotional with the rational, the more informed clients, customers are, and the better experiences, products, and services you can create.
Good stuff, and thanks for sharing that helpful advice for the listeners from your experience. Certainly interesting as well. Today we're joined by Ujjwal Arkelgood and Jason Partridge, co-founders of Motive Index, the leader in digital motivation research here on Enterprise Radio, a part of the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. You can also follow the show on Twitter simply at ePodcast Network. So tell me, how about those that are frustrated with corporate America and want to start their own company? What are some of your tips or lessons that you've learned along the way when starting a business?
Sure, and this is going to sound really cliche, and my business partner Jason will probably jump in as well, but I think there are two things we learned. Number one, resist the temptation to seek investment. Because as sexy as it sounds to say, oh, I got a couple million injected into the company and I can go hire 10 people, it often comes down to the question of, are you doing this because you believe in this and have a passion, or are you doing this because you want an ego boost? And if the answer is that you don't care about an ego boost, but rather about building the right type of company, then seeking investment is probably the wrong answer. So that was one of the first big realizations and learnings we had. And then the second one is sell. The only way to truly learn about your customer is to actually get on the phone with them, to make mistakes, to have the worst sales calls and also the best ones, and to understand what is it that will make you successful at the end of the day.
And just building off that, I think that, you know, the big realization was that you can learn something from everyone, so talk to everyone. You know, whether or not it's sitting down having a coffee or whether or not it is that good or bad sales call, there's a lesson to be learned in every single experience. And I believe that a lot of our success came from checking our egos at the door, being willing to listen. You know, this was a very academic product that we needed to pivot and make relatable to consumers, and so we needed to basically evolve quickly. We needed to change, and that is why I think we've celebrated the success, is we weren't afraid of that change, but that change was born from listening to people, understanding where other people were coming from, and then basically kind of working together to decide how we wanted to move forward on a day-by-day basis, on a week-by-week basis, and how we've gotten to year one.
Shifting gears, with tax time upon us, your firm recently released research saying Americans can't seem to save money, which is certainly the truth. Tell us about that study, if you would. Get into some of those facts and details.
Sure. So, you know, this is a very interesting topic and obviously relevant to everybody. But, you know, as a research company, we saw time and time again, every year there'd be a new study in the marketplace, and the study would be released by a financial institution, and the study would say, oh, we've talked to Americans, especially middle class and upper middle class Americans, and we understand that they're not saving enough, but they have big plans. They're going to save an extra 20% this year. And of course, the year passes by, and then the next study is released saying, oh yeah, Americans didn't save last year, but they promise to save more this coming year. And this cycle keeps continuing. And so we ask ourselves the question,
why is this happening? Why do people say one thing in a survey but do the exact opposite? In fact, today, I think in a recent statistic I read, almost 50% of the American population has almost no savings at all, which is an incredibly tough scenario to be faced with. And in many ways, financial institutions need to be solving this problem, because obviously not only does it help them and they get to sell more products and services, but it also helps all of us as consumers at the end of the day. So when we looked into this and used our team of PhD sociologists to study over 4,500 Americans online, and our focus was the bottom 97% of income earners in America, the thing we realized, and this was, you know, a big aha, and it's very counterintuitive, 80% of Americans do not believe in delayed gratification. This is a huge statement, because guess what every financial institution does when they try and sell you a savings product, an RRSP, some sort of a investment product? They tell you, imagine your retirement. You're on a boat. You're in a fishing village. You're on the beach somewhere. They tell you about a life that you may or may not lead 20, 30, 40 years from now, and they expect you to believe in delayed gratification. They expect you to change your ways, because when you're 65 or 70, you want something. And this is a fundamental disconnect between what the consumer wants versus what financial institutions think they want.
Now, the interesting thing here is that if you sit down with somebody and you start talking to them about their finances, you start talking to them about money, again, we're almost pre-programmed to deliver the answers that you're expecting. Because if I sit there and I basically say, do you think savings is a good idea? It's not in us to say no to that question. It's not in us to basically say that, you know, I'm planning on living with debt. It's not in us to basically say I'm going to rack up more on my credit card this year. It's almost like money has this social taboo around it. And so the problem is that, you know, the words that people use to articulate how they're going to act do not connect directly back to the actual actions that they have. Because as Ujjwal was alluding to, the motivation of saying that, you know, if you basically suffer now, you will reap the rewards later, is not relevant to a large portion of the population. So again, you know, this was a bit of an important finding for us, because it said that a new approach needed to be taken.
And just in the context of that new approach, here's a really interesting stat. We uncover that almost 47% of the population actually uses the excuse of doing things for other people. Essentially, what that means is that for a lot of people, saving actually needs to be associated or needs to have a purpose with it. And let me explain what I mean by purpose. For people, saving isn't about looking 30, 40 years in the future. It's not about delayed gratification, but rather it's about tomorrow. It's about the next year. It's about what you're going to do to buy your dream house or your dream car, or remodel your kitchen, or go on an amazing family vacation, or make sure that your children have the best extracurricular education, and so on. So the funny thing is, the only time when people actually change their habits and start to save is when they associate themselves a purpose with the notion of saving. And that purpose usually has to do with an excuse that says, I'm doing this for somebody else. It's making me feel like a better mom, better dad, better partner. That's the magic formula here. So in many ways, financial institutions need to stop saying, think about your retirement, and start saying, think about how you're going to ensure that the next 5 years are the best 5 years your family will ever live, or your children will get all the experiences they want to have, or that you might be able to start that business you've been wanting to start for the last 5 years. It's a slight, subtle shift, but it's of huge importance, because if you do not give consumers the alibi, the excuse, if you do not tip your hat to the fact that the consumer needs a purpose to be associated with the notion of saving, you're never going to motivate them to change their behavior.
stunning information. And I would be curious, for a research study such as the one that you've just mentioned, how many Americans did you profile here?
So in this particular case, we actually profiled over 4,500 Americans. And this was a study we did to really, purely out of interest and out of our passion for the industry. But typically when we work with our clients across a range of sectors, and we work with a lot of Fortune 500 clients across, you know, personal finance and retail and consumer packaged goods and so on, we typically study 7,000-8,000 consumers each and every time, because studying that many consumers allows you to identify certain trends that you couldn't even fathom existed. And that's where the excitement it really lies for all of us as researchers, but also for our clients, because they can identify opportunities that their competitors don't know exist.
And if you would, take that same study and turn it into a survey, why would that survey be ineffective?
So, you know, it was interesting as we were going through this process, because I found this really interesting little quote that it was British in nature, but basically said that you have a better chance of finding out from somebody in Britain what's happening in their bedroom than you do of what's happening in their bank account. And as we dug into it a little bit more, you know, we started seeing all these different little kind of indicators that were suggesting that, you know, there was like large portions of the population that had a bank account that their significant other didn't know about. And those were just those little kind of things that basically reminded us that when it comes down to money, the things that I'm going to express are very, very guarded and very, very protected. You know, I'm really tempted to use a vault analogy here because it's very fitting. But, you know, so when you start to even look at something like a survey, you know, we're asking people to still reveal a portion of who they are, and I don't know who that's going to end up with. So I still have these built-in defense mechanisms that basically kind of make me answer that question, and there's a part of me that knows that somebody else is going to be assessing that, and whether or even as much as I try to reveal myself, we have 20 years of evolution that basically makes me aware of other people and how they're going to interpret what I'm doing. The only thing that allows us to truly, truly basically see people for who they truly are is to observe them as a fly on the wall where we are unobserved. That is essentially what we're able to do, leveraging the data that's out there on the internet. You know, we are able to look at publicly available information, and like that person that sits on a park bench in a park and watches the people to see the patterns that start to present themselves, that's essentially what we are doing, but leveraging the online data, which is proving incredibly successful for our clients.
Well, gentlemen, certainly has been a pleasure to have had you both. Very insightful, informative, great business tips and advice as well. Certainly appreciate that. How can companies reach you if they want to perform a similar type of research study?
Sure. They can reach us on our website, motiveindex.com. I'll spell it MOTIVINDEX. And you might notice that Motive is spelled without an E there, because we are, after all, a startup and we need to sound cool. You can also reach us on by email at Jason, J-A-S-O-N, at motiveindex.com. Thank you so much for having us today. It was really fun chatting with you.
And I couldn't agree more. Gentlemen, it has been a pleasure to have had you, and certainly look forward to a future conversation with an update right here on Enterprise Radio.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We have been speaking with Ujjwal Arkelgood and Jason Partridge, co-founders of Motive Index, the leader in digital motivation research. And for more information, simply visit motiveindex.com. And this is Eric Dye, and you've been listening to Enterprise Radio, a part of EPN, the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Pick up our iPhone or Android mobile app for your mobile listening convenience. And once again, we do thank you for tuning in.
Thanks again for listening to Enterprise Radio here on the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. To subscribe for future programming, simply visit epodcastnetwork.com.
This is the ePodcast Network.